you are already old almost as soon as you reach maturity. By the time you're 18, you're on your way. And I think that's the time you begin to say, what's the point?
There are people who claim like they have like non-narrative selves, like they don't feel like they've got pasts and futures, and they feel like they're living perpetually in the moment. You hear people who practice meditation, mindfulness, Buddhism, feeling like they have this concept of not self, and their lives feel as if they're happening right now. And you might not think that those people are reaching towards a telos, an end or a purpose. Do you think that's possible for us to do and still live happy, fulfilled lives? Like, is having a goal, setting a goal in our lives, essential from a clinical perspective to our well-being?
No, because there are always alternative perspectives. And actually, there are some major alternative perspectives. So, for example, something like Taoism. I mean, often the contrast is made between Western and Eastern thought. And if you take something like Taoism, the emphasis is very much on harmony, on sort of going with the flow, rather than establishing a single purpose, a point in life. And the emphasis falls rather on non-action rather than action. But I still think that there's something within that which is goal-like. It might not be sort of goal-oriented as a philosophy, but so, for example, if I decide that I want to become a Taoist, that is a goal. So even in a sense, trying to live goallessly is a kind of goal. And I think that's something to do with the fact that finding meaning is just so fundamental to being human. I mean, it's as embodied as having an arm or a leg. I mean, if you think about, you know, the way the brain functions, I mean, we know we have a frontal lobe, and that's the most recent evolutionary development. And it's kind of defining. And the prefrontal cortex, what does it do? Well, it does many things, but I guess a very significant part of frontal lobe functioning is setting goals. And if we also look in a more broader sense at the structure of the brain, and we think of it in terms of the left and right hemispheres, the current sort of preeminent writer about left and right hemispheric function is Ian McGilchrist. And of course, the relationship between the hemispheres is extremely complex. But when McGilchrist is pushed and you say, well, okay, what does the left hemisphere do? What's its most fundamental setting? What does the right hemisphere do? He says, well, the left hemisphere is about manipulating the world, and the right hemisphere is about understanding the world and investing it with meaning. So it's absolutely fundamental to being human. It's actually sort of, you know, a part of our embodiment as such.
Well, we've got a couple of experts on existentialism here on the panel. Jonathan, I'd like to go to you first on this. I wonder if, you know, when we're thinking of existentialism and trying to live authentically and have self-knowledge, whether or not imposing these meanings on ourselves might not be helpful in the sense of it might restrict what we think we can do and infringe on our well-being in that way.
So I think that's right, yeah. I mean, I think 2 points. One, the existentialist tradition will very much prefer the idea that you don't find, as I said earlier, a meaning and impose that upon yourself and somehow constrain what you're doing, but somehow create or generate a meaning out of your own situation, out of your own experience, out of your own life. And that's what makes that meaning kind of authentic. I mean, in the literal sense of the word, it's yours, right? It's come from you. And secondly, I think, as far as I read the psychological literature, the experimental literature, that's the kind of meaning which grounds a kind of resilience, right? Which grounds a kind of ability to take things in your stride, no matter what, come what may, partly because it gives you the structure required to subsume the difficulties in your current experience and the setbacks you experience into that overall project, right? They become part of how you pursue the goal that you're trying to pursue. So that's the idea.
Okay, Babette, yeah. Do you want to come in on this?
I would, and I think I've just noticed that I have the whitest hair on this panel. And one of the points about a journey in search of a destination is you know where you're going. It's really very clear. And one of the things that Nietzsche does, one of his most existential reflections, he's not an existentialist, it's too soon for that, neither was Kierkegaard, but Nietzsche quotes David Hume. And he quotes this very, very frightening poem. He quotes it in English, David Hume, and from the dregs of life, hope to receive what the first, sprightly running, could not give. And then David Hume has a very complicated sentence that follows after that, ruining what his
Scots
way.
That was just as complicated.
Well, of course, but it gets worse. It says, he says, thus at last they find, such is the greatness of human misery, it reconciles even contradictions, now we're talking Graham Priest, that they complain at once of the shortness of life, that's Seneca, and of its vanity and sorrow. So I think that what happens when young people run into this question of purposelessness in life, it's when they begin getting to a certain age, which happens almost immediately. This is one of the beauties of senescence, that you are already old almost as soon as you reach maturity. By the time you're 18, you're on your way. And you still think still young, but you know better. And I think that's the time you begin to say, what's the point? And as you proceed, that pointlessness tends to accelerate. I think that simply saying, well, I can just put a meaning on it becomes a problem when you are looking at this journey. That's really the brilliance of the title of this talk, In Search of a Destination, because you're on that journey and you begin to see exactly where it's going and you begin then to say, what's the point?
Before we go to Sandra, Jonathan, I wonder if you want to come back on any of this. It seems, I saw your book, Rethinking Existentialism, where you talk about the purpose of being an existentialist, which seems to be something like to protect people's freedoms, to protect your freedom. Would you not say that that's sort of the point of being alive for everybody, to express and help other people be free?
So, right, good, thank you. So that's the argument that you find in, I think, most clearly in Simone de Beauvoir's book, Pyrrhus and Cineas, right, where she wants to connect the kind of Kantian idea that that because the source of all the value and meaning and purpose that we find in the world ultimately comes from us, from our own ability as human agents, from our own freedom to create value, that the ultimate ground of all value is that freedom, right? And so that freedom, therefore, is kind of objectively, supremely valuable because it's the fountain of all other value. And she wants to connect that, where Kant makes that as a kind of purely moral point in moral philosophy, she wants to make that an existential point about meaning and about purpose in life. So that's the way she understands authenticity in this much richer kind of moralistic sense that, as I say, because human agency is the ground of any meaning and purpose, it's supremely valuable. And that means it needs to be protected.
Okay, good. And that's wrapped up with the purpose in a sense, right? That we ought to be doing that, and so we're kind of driven towards it, or we should be driven towards it.
Yeah, it's not that we are, it's that we should be,
right.
And it's also that it sets a constraint, you see, because if you have the purely the idea that values are just grounded in your own project, then it looks like any project is valuable,
yeah.
Right? Anyone can do anything, right? There seem to be no moral constraints at all, whereas Beauvoir's thought is that's a mistake, right? It's because projects express human agency, that human agency is valuable. So projects that constrain other people's agency are disvaluable.
Okay, good. Sandra, what's your thought on this then? Like, the question I asked to begin with, is it possible to live a good life without having a purpose in life? But it seems like it has to be a worthwhile purpose as well. Like, it might not seem that I can live a fulfilling life if I'm just counting blades of grass. I need to actually do something more meaningful.
Actually, I think for many people, like I'm thinking of my mother who is really old, I mean, the purpose is just, you know, living, going at the end of the day. I mean, and for many people, it's just very limited. Goals like that are also very important. Mm. And also to think of a general purpose in life, I think, again, it's maybe something that is, I wouldn't say meaningless because we're interrogating the meaning of life, but if I quote Wittgenstein, I'm a favorite philosopher, you know, he's really convinced that there is no meaning to the idea of meaning of life because meanings are about words, and so you cannot say it's senseless to talk about meaning of life. But at the end of his book, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, which is a very metaphysical book, he really talks about the meaning of life. But he says, actually, that when someone has found the meaning of life, you have this feeling, you know, you talk to a very sage person and you always have this feeling of, you know, someone can be there and have found a purpose or meaning to her life. But actually, if you ask them, they won't say anything. I mean, the fact that when someone has found the meaning of life, then it becomes completely uninteresting and she has nothing to say about it. And I really like this idea. I think you just know, and obviously there is something.
To continue watching this video, click the link in the top left or in the description below.
With a free trial, you can enjoy the full talk and thousands more.
Thank you for being part of the conversation.